University Teacher of the Year Award, Australia's most prestigious teaching award. Dr. James is a professor in the humanities at the University of Western Sydney. His research areas include hope, trust, political theatre, piracy, and citizenship. He has worked as a human rights activist throughout the Pacific, Indonesia, and Europe. His 2009 book, Contemporary Society, A Sociological Analysis of Everyday Life, was launched with Oxford University Press, which gave rise to Sociologic, a weekly radio show on FBI Radio 94.5 FM, Australia. His latest book looks at the citizens of the 21st century. He is a regular speaker. Dr. James is a regular speaker at national and international conferences, delivering keynotes and research papers. While he has many testimonials, the one he is most proud comes from a year 10 student who approached him after a keynote at the Tarango Park Zoo, insisted on taking his photo and said, "Dude, you are awesome." Now I would request Monica to present a bouquet to Professor James Arvanitakis. The bouquet is there. I would request Professor Khaled Aziz to welcome the speaker. Thank you.
Professor James, colleagues and dear friends, it's a great pleasure for us that we have the renowned and recipient of the highest award to this university to speak on the innovative teaching. I welcome you to this university on my behalf, on behalf of the students and on behalf of the teachers of the Jamia. And we hope that this innovation, which is required everywhere, especially in teaching, because they are the teaching fraternity, and we have to ignite the minds of the students, minds of the learner, so that they can be able to think in different terms on social issues, on personal issues, on global issues, and search for the solutions to make this globe a humane and peaceful place to live. I welcome you and invite you for the lecture.
Thank you very much. Hello. Thank you very, very much for your wonderful introduction and your very warm welcome. I'm honored and humbled to be here today. Before I begin, I want to acknowledge Professor Talat Aziz. Thank you so much for the warm introduction. Of course, Professor Mukesh Ranjan, thank you for assisting us in arriving, in organizing this, and also I'd like to thank Dr. Bara Faruqi for assistance as well. I've been in India for a week. I leave tomorrow. It's been a very busy week. I've delivered, I think, 8 lectures. This is my number 8. So this was the one I was really looking forward to. I've heard some very good things about this university, and so I was very excited. I spent Monday and Tuesday at New EPA, and they assisted me in coming here as well, and they were very excited about me visiting. So thank you so much for being here. I'll begin by telling you just a little bit about my university. This is my university, University of Western Sydney. It's a fantastic university. Not because it's where I work. That helps, of course. It's not because it's where I work. It's because it's a very young university. It's only 25 years old. But it's been rated in the top 2% of universities around the world. So despite it being very young, it's been very successful. But what I love about it the most, and why I'm so proud to be here, is because it's a university that celebrates Australia's diversity. In my class, I run a class, I'll tell you a little bit about my classes, but in one of my classes, I have 1,168 students. Almost 1,200 students. In that class, one day, I estimated there was 193 different languages spoken. Okay, every religion represented, something like 78 countries. It was amazing. And this is the strength, I think, and we have a fantastic program at the university about promoting the diversity and the multiculturalism and the richness of society. So with your beautiful words, I want to say that this is the role of scholars. The role of scholars is to confront the challenges that we face today. All the challenges, from conflict to hunger, from climate change to food, and to solve those problems. And we can only solve it in exchanges, not big exchanges, both small exchanges and larger exchanges. So this is my university. This is me. Say hello. Hello. Okay, I began my career in finance. I actually studied economics when I first went to university. I worked in banking and finance for 9 years before moving into the area of human rights and environmental rights. And I worked all over the world. I worked in areas where there was conflicts and post-conflicts. I helped rebuild economies, places like Papua New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, Bougainville, and in part of Indonesia, parts of Indonesia. So I learned a lot in that experience. And about 8 years ago, I completed my PhD. That's my funny hat that you get to wear when you complete your PhD. So I'm a relatively young scholar. I've only been a PhD recipient 8 years ago. So, but in that time, I've been very lucky and have done a lot of different work. So as I mentioned, I teach two major areas. I teach an introduction to sociology. As I said, 1,168 students in this big lecture hall. It's amazing. I walk in every Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock and I am like an academic rock star. Yeah? There's just so many people. It's like a big concert. It's fantastic. And the students are very vibrant and they're passionate, and I can share some stories today. I also teach a smaller class of about 30 to 40 students. We have a program at the university called The Academy, and I'm the director of that program. And that program is about bringing together students from all different disciplines. The best students from law, from the humanities, from business, medicine, nursing. They all come together, and it's a leadership academy. We try and promote ethical leadership. We study ethics, we study leadership. We study conflict, peace and conflict studies, all those different things we bring together. And the teachers that we get together, no one class is allowed to have one teacher from any single discipline. So on Tuesday, I go back to university, I teach on Monday. On Tuesday, we have a class and we're analysing conflict, the historical conflict around parts of around World War II. And the lecture will be presented by a military historian and a solicitor, a lawyer. And so they will present the lecture. So it brings people together from different. It's very exciting. So I also have, as you mentioned, my radio show. I have a radio show every week. And also, this is also me on television. I have every 3 weeks, I have a television segment live on TV on ABC television, which is, and what I talk about there are any issues that people want me to talk about. So people call in, I'll talk about what's in the news, I'll tell them about this trip, I might even tell them about this university, you know, so it's a fantastic area. It's a very unique opportunity. And this is part of my philosophy. Part of my philosophy as scholars, and when I talk about scholars, I'm not just talking about the teachers, the faculty, I'm also talking about you as students. We're all scholars. Part of our scholarship has to be to teach outside the schoolroom, outside the classroom. My father was a builder. He carried bricks on building sites, the lowest paid worker. My mother cleaned and ironed. I have opportunities that they never had. You have those opportunities. And it's our role, for people who have those opportunities, to spread the messages that we hear, that we learn here, the messages, and to confront the challenges of the world. And that's why I'm such a passionate teacher. My favourite quote is that is by Robert Frost, who says, "I'm not just a teacher, I'm an awakener." And that's our role, to awaken. Yeah? And that's why I love what I do. And that's why I'm so honoured to be here. So thank you. I want to begin by telling you a story of a water pump. Now, it's a story about engineering, but its implication is much broader than engineering. Its implication is, I think, it will summarise my philosophical approach and some of the issues that we started discussing. A friend of mine works at an innovation company, and they wanted to hire 4 engineers. Student engineers, they wanted to do a one-year internship. They were offering good money for a one-year internship. And so they advertise this internship, and they have 77 applications from across the 6 major universities in Sydney. And so he rings me, and he says, "Hey, James." I say, "Hi, Imad." He says, "I've got 77 applications. Who should I interview?" And I said to him, as a joke, "You should interview them all." And he did. He decided to interview all 77. So the first interview comes. He walks in, and he says, sits down, they do the interview. And at the end of the interview, Imad says, "Show me something you've built." And the student says, "I've built a water pump." And he takes it out of his bag, puts it on the desk, and describes how the water pump works. The water goes in this way, it pumps things that way. "I built that." Imad's like, "That's impressive. It's good." Next student comes in, sits down, he interviews him. They talk for a bit. And he says, "Show me something you built." The student says, "Yeah, I'm very proud of something I built." Leans in, pulls out a water pump. And he says, "Oh, what university do you go to?" And he went to a different university. He goes, "Okay." And he says, "Show me how it works." And so he explained to him how it worked. Yeah. And the third student walks in. "Show me something you've built." And what does the student pull out? A water pump. And the fourth student. And the fifth student. And so on. And he's going crazy. He's going crazy because every student, he feels like he should ask them the same thing. "Tell me how it works." By this stage, he knows how it works, right? But he keeps on saying, because he has to be fair, "Show me how it works." And he's going crazy because he realizes that every student across every university learns the same thing. Student number 21 comes in. He interviews him and he says, "Show me something you've built." And the student says, "I've built a water pump." And he goes, "Show me the water pump." And he goes, "I didn't bring it, but I got some photos." So he leans into his bag and he pulls out his computer. And the computer is wrapped in black, thick, sticky tape. And he opens it up and he goes, "Stop, what's that?" And he says, "It's a computer." He goes, "No, I know it's a computer. What's around the computer?" And he says, "Oh, it's my cover." He goes, "Where'd you get that cover from?" He goes, "I made it myself." He goes, "Tell me how you made it or why you made it." He goes, "Well, covers are expensive. and they're designed to look good, but they're not very effective. They take up too much room, they don't protect the computer like they should. So I got frustrated, so I made my own. He goes, well, show me how you made it. And he showed him. And he said, you've got the job. Okay? Now, I tell you this story because I want to jump ahead here. Sorry. Because the story of the pump is a story of knowledge. Universities traditionally have been very good at giving knowledge. Yeah? That's what we do. That's what we do. We give you knowledge. As educators, we pass on knowledge. But my argument is that we now live in a world where knowledge is easily accessible. You can jump on Wikipedia and you can get as much information as what you can from every university. More pages of Wikipedia appear than what universities' information produce. So what do we teach? Well, we need knowledge. I'm not saying knowledge is not important. But my argument is that we also need to go beyond knowledge and teach skills and culture. Now, when I use the word culture, I use it specifically. I am talking about the culture of learning to learn. Right? The ability to as you confront different situations, as you confront different challenges, your ability to teach yourself, to reteach yourself. And when I talk about skills, that's what I research now. My job over the last few years has been to travel the world and interview successful individuals, successful companies. And when I say successful, I don't mean rich. I've interviewed some people who are very wealthy, but I've interviewed people who excel in what they do. And I ask them, what are the skills that you wish you'd learnt? What are the skills I should be teaching my students? And this is the model that we've come up with. Right? And I've been developing this over the last 5 or 6 years. And I am more than happy to leave this behind, leave this PowerPoint behind, and engage with you on these ideas. Because it's just a model. And models are there to be played with, to be built on, to be changed, to be challenged. So I'm only presenting it as a way to begin discussions. Okay. So these are some of the ideas. One idea. I'll give you an example. Literacy. Let me begin by focusing on the concept of literacy. Sorry. We can take another serious one. Okay. I promise you I'm a real professor. Sometimes people don't believe me. I'm just going to change the subject for a minute. I just got back from 3 weeks in China, and I was waiting for someone to come and collect me, and I was sitting on the lounge, and one of the students from one of the Chinese universities came to find me. And someone was sitting next to me, and she walked in and she asked the people at reception for Professor James. And so then she came over to where I was sitting, and they pointed her over to me, and she asked the person next to me if they were Professor James. And I said, no, I'm Professor James, and she wouldn't believe me. Anyway, so let's look at literacy. What does literacy mean today? Well, literacy, of course, means reading and writing and arithmetic. Yeah? That's of course it means that. But my argument is literacy also means other things today, and we need to expand its concept. Like for me, okay, for me, literacy also means internationalization. Learning to work with different cultures. Okay? All of us have to interact with multiple cultures. We need to focus on this idea. So at my university, we as I mentioned, the diversity, so we focus on this kind of cultural interaction. Yeah? So we have this concept that I'm developing and we've been developing over the last few years called cultural humility. How to interact with cultures for the first time when you don't really know the rules. Yeah, that's part of literacy. Yeah? The literacy of culture. Another part of literacy is dealing with information. Okay? So, this is a picture of my university when I was an undergraduate. Okay? The library. This was the library that I used to go to. I did a subject, my first degree was economics. So I used to do this economics subject. And I did this subject on
Australian microeconomic policy. Now you gotta imagine we're talking about 1989. So we're going back a few years. Yeah? 300 people in the class. The assignment was the essay, let's do an essay, on Australian manufacturing policy before the internet existed, yeah? Or before it was popular. In the library, the teacher says, okay, your assignment is Australian, is our Australian manufacturing policy, and the best book to read is this book. But I warn you now, there's only one copy in the library. So all the students don't even wait for the teacher to finish. We get up and we start running towards the library to be there, the first one there. And you get there and the book was held behind here, closed reserve. So it's not on the shelf, it's behind where the librarians hold it. And what you do is this. You have to line up with your library card, wait, and then you give the librarian, your card, and then she gives you the book. And she gives you, depending on the time of day, she gives you 15 minutes. Or she gives you an hour. Or half an hour, depending on if it's busy or not busy. You have 15 minutes, or they charge you $10 a minute if it's late. So what you do is you grab the book, you run as fast as you can to the photocopier, you photocopy every page, your friends are standing around saying, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. And then you turn around and you run back and you hand it in. Yeah? That was what it was like for me. Okay? That was a time of information scarcity, where information was hard. Yeah? Information was hard. Today we live in a time of information abundance. Information excess. So, today, if I gave you the assignment, Australian manufacturing policy, you would go to Google, you'd type in that word, and you'd have 1.8 million hits. Contrast. What's harder? One book, where you're running to get the book, or to find out which of the 1.8 million hits is worth reading? Yeah? They're both different. They're both very different, but they're both challenging. I'm not saying one's better than the other. I mean, it's good that the information is there, but even information is political, yeah? So what information do you use? So literacy, so this idea of literacy now must include data literacy, information literacy. Even if you're studying the humanities, you must know how to deal with data. Yeah? Does that make sense? So I'll give you another example. A friend of mine is a geneticist in the School of Medicine. And she says, she trains, she teaches doctors. Her job is to teach doctors on studying genetics. And she says, if you in Australia today went to get a genetic map of your body, it would cost you $3,000. A lot of money, yeah? So most people can't do it. But 3 years ago, it cost $25,000. By the end of the decade, it'll cost $80. And her message is that now you can put that genetic map on your phone. By the end of the decade, you could probably fit it on your watch. So the role of the doctor is no longer just to examine you, but also to be able to read your genetic map. So again, data becomes something that's part of literacy. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. So, there's lots of changes that the world has faced. And my argument is that we have changed, the world around us is changing rapidly, and we, as scholars, and again, when I say scholar, I include students as scholars because you are on the scholarly journey. We as scholars must also learn to adapt and change. I'm not saying that we accept the changes as they are. I'm saying that we must have the skills to assess those changes. So let's just go back a bit. And I want to talk about two things.
Okay, let's look at some of the changes that have happened. That's me. Say hi. Thank you. So that's me. This is my iPhone. Yeah, my smartphone. You know how old smartphones are when the first smartphone came out? Anyone want to guess? Sorry? How many years? Just have a guess. 7.5 years ago. On June 29, 2007, the first iPhone. I remember the first time I saw one. Someone pulled it out of the cafe. And did this, started playing with it, and the whole cafe went. It was like magic, yeah? Now, everyone has one. I see children that are like 10 years old sitting in cafes playing around with them. Oh, it's amazing. A friend of mine, he's got a one-year-old child. And we went there. I went to his house to watch the football. Right? So funny. And he's got quite a big TV. Yeah? And his son, his one-year-old, was watching a cartoon on television. And he said to his son, "Now, you know, Uncle James is here. We're going to get you to play with the iPad. We want to watch the football." And so he picked him up and he put him over there and he put the football on. And the son was like holding the screen like this. And looks at the TV, looks at the screen and goes, "No, I want to watch it on this. And he walked over the TV and he did this. He's trying to slide it. It's amazing, yeah? So the world is changing. The way that we touch things and feel things and screens and this and that. So this is the world that we're living in, and so we need to be able to adapt to that world. So I tell the story, it's a simple story, that this is my phone and this was the first mobile phone in Australia. This thing here. You know how heavy it was?
10 kilos.
It was 10 kilos. I want you to think of 10 kilos, right? This is probably about 7 kilos. Imagine walking around and this is your mobile phone. It's crazy, yeah? And on top of that, you've got to carry your books. Yeah? 10 kilos. Mobile phone. If you walk into a cafe, you need two seats. One for you and one for your phone. It's insane. It's crazy. And that's changed very quickly. And so, and you know, I can tell you, like, it used to cost $5 a minute for a phone call. Like, that's how expensive it was. You know, so it's changed. And so, here's another example. This is a computer from 1965. The computer was about the size, about three times the size of this room. Yeah? It was a single processor. It means it could only do one function at one time. This is a microwave oven from 2013, 2 years ago. This has got more processing power than that computer. Do we ever look at a microwave oven and go, "Oh, look at it, it's magical"? No, it's just something that's everyday. So that's the first thing. The world is changing rapidly. The second thing, and here's something I say to my students. I give my students this challenge. I say, "Draw me a tablet." Right? I ask them to draw me a tablet. And for me, when I was growing up, this was a tablet. You have a headache, you take a tablet. This is a tablet now. Right? If you type in tablet into, if you go to Google Images and you type in tablet, first 13 pages is this. It's crazy, right? So I said to my friends, my students, "Draw me a mobile." You know a mobile? And they draw me a phone. A mobile is that little thing that dangles above the baby's bed. And they go, "What's that? We've never heard of it." So again, right? So these changes. Okay. The second thing that's changed is the environment that we live in. Now, in Australia, and I know it's the same here, but I think the longer-term trend could well be, and again, it's an area of discussion. Newspapers in Australia used to be incredibly influential, incredibly powerful. They used to make hundreds of millions of dollars. Yeah? But newspapers today are losing money. Why? Because the internet.
Newspapers used to control content. They used to control information. But now if you want news, yeah, you can go buy a newspaper, but there's many other places to get it. Just like universities. Yeah? So newspapers and universities have this in common. Now, when I was at university, this is what it was like. Yeah? The professor would stand at the front, would talk, I would take notes, and then he would say, go read page 77 to 112, and we'd all go home and do it. Today, the world looks more like this. The professor is talking, and my students can constantly communicate, be it via Facebook or text message or our own. We have at our university, we have a learning management system, so students can jump online and communicate. So, and amongst that is knowledge is mediated by other organisations. Media organisations, NGOs, corporations, religious organisations, all sorts of organisations influence it. And this is a challenge, because if we go back to literacy, and I will say this. In Australia, there was a survey done amongst young people, 16 to 18. And they asked them, which information do you trust the most? And 40% of the students that answered that question, 40% said the internet, beyond their parents, beyond their teachers. In my class, I've had a student say to me, I disagree with what you just said. And I said, why? And I said, because Wikipedia says something different. Like, I'm smarter than Wikipedia. And she's like, no, you're not. So this is a different environment, a very different environment.
So how do we respond? Well, I mentioned this. But in addition, my argument is that we need a new pedagogical approach. And I want to spend, I've got about 15 more minutes, yeah? About 15 more minutes. I'm going to spend the last 15 minutes talking about the pedagogical approach which I've developed and which saw me win the award. Before a student comes to class, okay, let me just take a step back. What I found with my students is that they studied and they memorized. They didn't learn. Does that make sense? It's a difference. The difference. You can pick up a textbook, you can read it and read it and memorize it. The exam came and they would just write what was in the textbook. They weren't learning the stuff. They weren't learning the information. So this is about an applied pedagogy. It's about an applied approach. Because what I believe is this, is that the knowledge that we have, the knowledge that we learn, must be applied. Right? And that's what makes it powerful. It's not powerful if we don't learn it. So this is what I do. So you've got to imagine I have 1,200 students in my class. Of the 1,200, about 800 are doing this compulsory subject. It's a compulsory subject for them. The other 400 are doing it as an elective. The subject is essentially an introduction to the humanities. It's an introduction to sociology and cultural studies. So they learn gender, class, race, religion, globalization, technology, and so on. They're very, very important things. And I believe it doesn't matter if you're studying sociology or you're studying engineering or you're studying mathematics, they're really important things to learn. Yeah? So I changed the way I taught. I begin at the end and work backwards. And let me explain to you. Before a student comes to class, I challenge them to think of the world around them. Okay? I give them something to read and something to watch. I don't tell them anything about the theory. Yeah? So I'll show you, for example. This is a video I made about society and the environment. okay? Because I teach environment as part of this subject as well. It's society's relationship to the environment. So they watch this, and this gives them a bit of an introduction. I'll just show you 30 seconds of this. That's me. I had long hair.
Hey everyone, welcome to Tasmania. James, well, we're in Missionary National Park down on the east coast of Tasmania. And Tasmania is one of the most beautiful places I've ever been and hung out and visited. I have some good friends and family there. And today we're looking at the country of Tasmania as a place.
Okay, you don't need to say anything else. But what the video does is it introduces the students in this one. I think goes for about 6 minutes, a bit less. It introduces the students to the broad concept of what we're going to talk about. Okay, so say watch this video. Then what I do? Okay, so I'm talking about this part of the diagram thing. Then what I do is I get them to read something that's recent. So this is something that happened recently in the United States, okay? And it was featured in the Australian newspapers. So this is a photo from that. And it was about a police officer who shot a young black man, yeah? And it created massive riots in the United States, okay? And the topic, the area of topic, what we're covering here is environment and conflict. So I want to talk about conflict in society. Why sometimes societies work peacefully and why sometimes they are in conflict. So I want the students to think about conflict. Yeah, this is before I tell them anything about theory. Yeah. So they read, they watch the video, get some background, then they read an article that's relevant today. So they learn that what we're studying is relevant now. It's happening in the world around them, and it's impacting their lives. Okay. So when they walk into the classroom, knowing we're going to talk about something that's relevant. It's going to impact their lives. It's going to impact the lives of their friends. Yeah? Does that make sense? Okay. When they come to class, go back here. When they come to class, the class is very interactive and has specific exercises and challenges. And I'll talk about that in a minute. And then here, afterwards, is when I give them the theoretical discussions. So we start with the case study. We apply the case study to our lives, and then I give them the theory. Because what they do when they read the theory, well, usually what happens is by the time we get the theory, they're hungry to know. They want to know why society is in conflict. They can understand different pieces, but I say if you want to understand the picture, it's now time for you to read the theory. And I'll do a similar thing around class and class relationships. I begin by talking about how different schools in Australia get different funding. Why does one school receive $3,000 a year per student and another school receive $24,000 a year per student? Why does that happen? Who went to that school? Who goes to that school? Which school did our politicians go to? Yeah? They see it, it impacts their lives. I get them to apply it, then I say, if you want to understand what's going on, now we're going to read class relationships. Now we go back and we read the relevant theory. Does that make sense? Right. So knowledge becomes like a piece of clay. Knowledge becomes something that the student takes, plays with, applies, and then and learns it. Doesn't just memorize it, but learns it. So so here's an example. I won't have time to go there. I'll skip that. It's about apples. Okay. Now, just a few more things before I finish off, about 8 minutes. Okay. Here's a challenge for you as scholars. Our classes are an hour long. Why are they an hour long? Well, there's no research that says that an hour is the best time, best way to teach someone. An hour is a measurement of time. It's not a class. Okay? So my colleagues don't like me saying this because I say, what's your answer? Well, this is the problem with an hour. The problem with an hour is this. This is the attention span in the class. Right? This is when the students walk in, they're excited. It's me. When I walk into a meeting, I'm excited. This is the students losing concentration. I call this Facebook time. Yeah? By this time, they started doing Facebook, and then they've switched off. And then here, see this bit here? When you say right at the end of the exam, you say right at the end, what you need to know for the exam is, and everyone's like, quick, let me write that down. Yeah? Now, what's important about this research is that it was done in 1992 and 2000. So it's old research. It's research before the internet. It's research before the internet. And I've done experiments with my colleagues at work. I've said to them, I want you to tell me, we're inside a lecture, go to hear conference papers, I want you to take a note when you start thinking about your shopping, when you start thinking about something else. And most of them, these are professors, yeah? Most of them write down about 15 minutes. And I say, tell me what you're thinking about. And usually it's their shopping. But I've got to buy the milk on the way home. You know, it's my wife's birthday tomorrow, I've got to send the flowers. You know, these are the types of things, right? So, and research shows that what a student remembers in a class is if you just talk like this, is if you just lecture straight, is that it only remembers 10% of what you teach them. Now for me this is really important because my second name is James Abanapakis. Once the student remembers that's 10% gone. That's it, that's all I've got. Now, what I do in class is this. I actually break down my class like this. What I aim to do, and you know how I said there's in-class exercises? What I actually do with my in-class exercises is every 10 or so minutes, I talk for about 8 minutes. I then get the students to do an interaction. I talk for another 8 minutes, interaction, and so on and so on and so on. Yeah? So they're constantly interacting. The recalling of information improves by 400% if you get people to interact in class. 400%. So if I'm teaching society, what is society, and so on. So 4 mini lectures. So rather than being 1 hour, an hour lecture, I give 4 mini lectures. I'll skip that. Okay. Now, one of our challenges, because of information, is to always create new challenges for students. So, I design ungoogable questions. Okay? Now, this is important for me for various reasons. One is because the students themselves, I say to them, when you get a job, when you go work, if the people you work for can get everything they want from Google, then why would they employ you, right? And two, it means that students learn about the process of how things are done, not just the answer, yeah? Okay, so I want to set you guys now an ungoogable question, okay? Here's one that I developed the other day, okay? And I just want you to spend 2 minutes talking about it, just to think about how you would answer it. The bookstore. You recognize this?
Yes.
Yeah? Everyone recognizes this. It's about a kilometer long. Yeah? It's about a kilometer long. It's amazing, right? My ungoogable question. How many books are sold every Sunday? Or how many books are available for sale every Sunday? Now, you can say to me right now, 1,132,498. I don't know. You could be right. But it's not the answer that's important, right? It's how you would go about doing it. So, I want to give you 2 minutes just to discuss amongst yourselves. I'm not going to ask for an answer, but just think about how you would go about it. Go. Talk.
That's better.
Okay. All right. Does anyone want to say anything? Does anyone want to share there? Yes, sir.
Well, there are about 50 shops there, and this picture is enough to give you an idea. There are about 500 or 600 books there.
Yeah.
So multiply 50 by 500. That's one way to.
Okay. Perfect. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I just think that there are many books. It's not really important how many it comes from.
Yeah.
And I would rather be interested to know what books are there, which I cannot see. But then that's also besides the point, because I know I'm in a lecture and this is that. So I really didn't count at all.
Okay. Well, maybe that's another question. How many books are worth of the 50 by 500, how many books are worth reading? Maybe that's another conversation to have. And that's a philosophical conversation, right?
I knew it's useless to count because you have only, I believe, 2 minutes now.
Yeah, of course. But I'll tell you one of the answers someone told me the other day. Someone said, just quickly, they said, and if this was a class, I would give my students 20 minutes, right? And so they would then begin, so I'll give them a chance. And what I do is I get them to write out for me the logic, right? So they actually build a logic map, yeah? Because I'm interested in the process, not the answer, yeah? So one of the answers would be, that is about this high, each is about a kilometre long, each book is about this wide, about this thick. If you put this many books side by side and this wide, this times this gives you an answer, yeah? So it's, you know, it's just made up. But the important thing is the process, yeah? It's the ability to take that knowledge and to try and think differently. So you know, one of the challenges I set my students is to tell me, you know the Harbour Bridge in Australia? Yeah? You know the Harbour Bridge, yeah? I asked them, how heavy is the Harbour Bridge? How would you weigh the Harbour Bridge, yeah? And so they all look at me like, come on, how do you do that, right? And I say, well, tell me how you would do it. And so they come up with all these very, very creative answers, you know? So one of the answers that someone gave me was, she said, she's pretty, like, they work in teams, yeah? They work in teams. And this was the coolest answer. Like, I give them extra marks if it's creative. So one of the answers was, it's about 300 metres long. It's 8 lanes wide. The average elephant is about 3 metres long, so it's 100 elephants that way, times this way, and the average weight of an elephant is so big, and then she calculated it. And I said, oh, are you talking about African elephants or Asian elephants? And she's like, African. I went, okay, that's better. So again, right, it's creative. It's just trying to think, it's trying to get people to think differently. Okay, so I'm going to skip that. Okay, so I'm going to finish off by just saying 3 kind of lessons I hope we take away. The first is that I believe that we as scholars need to be what we want our students to be. If we want our students to be critical, creative, innovative thinkers, if we want our students to promote peace and we want our students to be active, we need to demonstrate that. Yeah? We can't just say it, we need to show it. In our behaviours, in the way we run the class. Two, I believe that knowledge is like clay. I don't believe any theory shouldn't go unchallenged. I don't believe there's any idea that we shouldn't be brave enough to challenge it. I'm not saying that you always break it, I'm just saying we need to be able to challenge it. Because only after you interrogate something can you truly then feel that you can trust it. Yeah? And finally, we must start at the end. We must imagine the type of student we want to produce. Right? I want a certain type of student to leave my class. I want a creative, innovative, critical thinking student who promotes issues of justice. Right? That's what I want my student to walk out with. Doesn't matter what they're studying, sociology or teaching, engineering or mathematics, that's the vision I have for my student. The knowledge they learn, that's content, they get that in the discipline. So what else we can teach them? Thank you.
If our students are keen to ask questions, you know, they may find it. Anyone in the audience? Yeah, please, sir. Please, sir.
You have 800 plus 400 students in your class. How do you give tests to them and grade their answers and so on? Yeah. Is that something that you spend a lot of time?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I should have explained that. I have about 20 assistant teachers. But you know what?
You don't have any teaching
assistants. Yeah, the associate teachers, they give you more trouble than the students. So the way that the Australian system works is we have the big class where they all come together, and then over the next while, then they break off into smaller classes. Sometimes I have classes of 200, and the assistant teachers are in the class with me, and they engage with students. And they're long classes; they might be 3-hour classes, so they're very, very interactive. Just a little bit about the assistant teachers, the way that they operate, is I have very, very different assistant teachers, right? Because you have 20 different teachers that all behave and have very different styles. So I don't tell them how to teach. I just tell them at the end what I want the students to have learned. So the example I gave today was, I have one teacher, he's very formal, very, very formal. Comes every day in a suit and sits there, and he's very formal in class, you know. With the way he marks, he marks at the beginning of semester, he marks very hard. Yeah. Now I have this other teacher, and she's a hippie. she's like, everyone's awesome, I love you all. Total hippie, right? You know? And she's like, comes to class and she's always like, okay, let's all be in a circle. You know? And what she does is at the beginning of the semester, she marks really easy. Yeah? So we have these two different scenarios. But what happens is she tells her students, every assignment, I'm going to mark a little bit harder. A little bit harder. A little bit harder. And this guy here, the formal one, he becomes softer as the semester goes, right? Two very different styles, but at the end, we meet 3 or 4 times over the semester, and we always compare marks and compare how it's going, and I always find the average is about the same. When I say about the same, I mean 72.6 versus 72.8, you know, very marginal. And if it's not, then we investigate why. And we investigate why. But usually we know it early. And sometimes you have those classes where the students just happen to be brilliant or they're struggling. So sometimes you do get variations, but we try and find that out earlier on. But yeah, good question. Yes, sir.
You said I'm teaching law. I'm teaching law. Indeed, the teaching method, that is the transmission of knowledge from the teacher's mind to the student. You have rightly said that before the student comes into the class, you introduce the subject by giving him the case study and to learn something. So that after he comes, he is aware about what we are going to teach, and he grasps the knowledge. Yeah. And then he plays with the knowledge like play. And then you have to keep in your mind that what you are going to produce the student, and that with that focus, you can make the strategy, knowledge, something else, and to transmit that knowledge to the student's mind, that what you have all demonstrated, that is the strategy. How do you prepare this strategy? Number one. Number two, how do you take the test, that is the examination of the student? Because that is another part of the teacher, yes, which is very important.
Yeah,
so these are the two questions.
Yeah, look, I'll answer that by giving a couple of examples, and then I'll tell you about the tests. A friend of mine teaches, obviously I've been a colleague to teach law, yeah? And so one of the things that this friend of mine does, this colleague of mine does, is she will often, she'll teach something and she'll say to the students, I want you to find, right, I want you to watch this movie, right? And in this movie, it's about lawyers, or this show is about lawyers. And there's a case in there, and I want you to watch it, and I want you to analyze it from what we're going to learn, okay? And I want you to see what's wrong, what they've got wrong in the movie, okay? And so what happens is, the students are like, what, I have to watch a TV for homework? And she goes, yes. But not watch, analyze. Yeah? And all of a sudden, the students feel, she's found that, you know, just those little things of saying, of seeing it applied that way, becomes an, they begin to see it, they start seeing the knowledge, not just as words on a paper, but something that's living. She gets them to read newspapers, if there's a famous case, something that's happening in the news today, where something's happened. And she's gone, how do we apply jurisprudence to that? How do we apply to this? She's also crazy for cricket. She loves cricket. And she says, one of the assignments she says is, what does cricket and the common law have in common? Right? And so it's a fun assignment, right? And the students think it's a joke. But what they begin to do is they kind of begin to go, oh, there's a jury of the peers, there's the idea of fairness, the British idea of fairness, you know, how that's imbued in the law, and this is all part of the jurisprudence lessons. So it's an application the way that you apply it, but it's important, the content of course is important, she has to teach the law. For me, exams have changed a lot. Okay, so the way I teach exams is this, is I don't have exams for all my subjects. Again, we don't have to have exams for all our subjects. Some you do, some you don't. But one of the ways I was really interested in application of knowledge was this, is for the exam now, I will photocopy, I'll get copies of certain newspaper articles, yeah? And I'll ask the students in the exam, not tell me what gender is, but read the article and explain to me how the author talks about gender. Yeah? It's a very different way to study gender. Yeah? Read this article and explain to me the racist language. Or read the article and talk to me about the cultural misunderstanding. Yeah? So that they don't have to memorize the definition. They have to know how to apply it. Because if they can apply it, that means they know it. So it's a much more applied way for this knowledge. So that's the sense. But thank you for that question.
Yes, please.
Sir, I'm a science teacher, and I have a student like me to serve the data. So I will put some things in front of you and translate it. Ninth, when a Hindi teacher, one of का दोहा पढ़ के हिंदू मुसलमान का मजाक उड़ा रहे थे तो मैंने सवाल पूछा है ना उस पर सर नाराज हो गए मेरे सवाल का जवाब नहीं दिया हिस्ट्री के टीचर अरब सभ्यता पढ़ा रहे थे तो मोहम्मद साहब का जो है मजाक उड़ा रहे थे मैंने उस पर सवाल पूछा है ना मेरे सवाल का जवाब नहीं दिया सर नाराज हो गए जो बात किताब में लिखी हुई है फिर बायोलॉजी के टीचर डार्विन का सिद्धांत पढ़ा रहे थे तो मैंने जब सवाल पूछा डार्विन के सिद्धांत पर मैंने आपत्ति व्यक्त किया कि नहीं ऐसा नहीं है और मैंने क्वेश्चन किया तो उस पर भी ऐसा जवाब नहीं था जामिया मिल्लिया इस्लामिया में जब मैं सोशियोलॉजी कर रहा था सोशियोलॉजी तो मैंने मनीषा पांडे से सवाल पूछा कार्ल मार्क्स के थ्योरी के बारे में, उसकी लाइफ के बारे में, पूरी आइडियोलॉजी के बारे में. तो मैम भड़क गई, जबकि मैम लंदन से पढ़ के आई, पीएचडी करके आई है. और मैडम ने कही तुम तो ऐसे सवाल करते जैसे जर्नलिस्ट. तो हमारे क्लास के सारे जो है बच्चे जो भी हमारे क्लासमेट थे सब हंसा. उसको पता था कि ये बंदा पहले से जो है उर्दू हिंदी का प्रेस रिपोर्टर है. तो सवाल ये पैदा होता है कि बच्चे जो है स्टूडेंट अगर सर से नहीं क्वेश्चन करेंगे, उससे नहीं सेटिस्फाई होंगे, कहाँ से वो सवाल का जवाब कहाँ से लाएंगे.
Okay. Well, that's quite a longish thing, and I'll just give you the gist of it. You know, how does the student respond when the teacher is not very receptive to his question?
Look, so how does the student respond?
Yes, you know, sometimes so there could be a teacher, you know, who takes, you know, exception, you know, to certain observations, you know, made by a student, or it's not very receptive, you know, to what is.
This is a really important question. Because you know, in a class as big as we have, for the ones that I have, there are many students who have ideas I disagree with. Some of them are fine, I don't like it all. My rules in the class are two. One is, whatever opinion you have, you have to have it, has to be respected. You have to respect the people around you. Two, you can argue any position you want as long as you can justify it with academic material. Yeah? So, if someone wants to argue with me about, wants to argue against multiculturalism, I encourage them to ask that question, because if they don't ask me in class, they're going to have that conversation with their family. They want to ask the question, and this has happened recently. You know, some of the students took a, to be honest with you, took an anti-Islamic position, began to look at the incidents around the world and said, you know, why is Islam one? And I'm glad they asked that question, because I then answer it. I then get other students to answer it. I then give them readings to read. Because, as I say, if they don't ask me that question, and if I don't arm them with the language and the knowledge to be able to respond, then they're not going to be able to have that conversation with anyone else. Yeah? So they can then talk to their parents, hopefully. And that's one of my beliefs. I can teach that sort of question. If the student refuses to engage in that, I say, you're always entitled to your opinion, as long as A, you don't offend, and B, it's justified. Again, show me where you think multiculturalism doesn't work. Show me evidence, and then you can build your essay around that, or your response around that, and then we can begin a debate. Let's have an informed debate. There's many students I don't agree with, but like I said, I'd rather have that discussion in class than not have that discussion at all. Because many students, because I know there's environments where students can't ask questions. They will say what you want to hear, but when they're out with their friends or their family, they say what they're really thinking. So I'd rather have an environment where we can draw out what needs to be said.
Thank you. Yes, please.
So I have this question, like you started that you both give your students material to work upon so that they get exposed to it. And later, like my question is that, so in terms of the liberalism that you are giving to your students, what happens that getting the good materials out from the internet or somewhere else, how does you make ensure that they are getting that, they're getting the right material, I mean, to debate upon next day on the topic? The second question is the skill part. So like you focus a lot on the skills, like knowledge plus skill. That thing like really well, but the skill thing is like, it's really hard, I mean, to impart skill on some other part. Like even if you take the addition, single digit addition, if you want to teach that to a kid, it's really hard, I mean, to teach them. My question is it the practice only can make a person to get that skill, or like your method is something else to impart the skill part?
Look, I think skills can only be taught by practice. It's like watching someone play the guitar or practicing the guitar. You just watch someone, you think, oh, yeah, I can watch it, but it has to be practice. So the work that we do in class is very much based around developing those skills. And you start small. You start with small challenges and you build the challenges as the semester goes.
So it's a very small one. I want you to try this. Think about it. Now I want you to think about this. And practice. So these skills have to be practiced, but they have to be embedded in the curriculum. They have to be embedded. So it's not something like, I'll teach this, then on top of that I'll add this. It has to be embedded in the curriculum. So again, if you think about my assessment, my exam, about read the newspaper and tell me what the author says about this. Yeah? That is a skill about, that is not only a skill about learning the content, that is a skill about critical thinking. Yeah? So it's applied critical thinking right there. Read this, critically analyze it, and draw it out. So the critical thinking skill that I'm promoting is embedded into the assessments. Yeah? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So the first part of your question, sorry, I got excited about the second part, and I forgot the first part.
Okay, should I repeat it?
Please, please.
So like my question is that how do you encourage your students like to get right information? Like you said that you have students from different backgrounds.
Yeah.
So like it's really hard, like if you start a debate over there would be conflict for sure. Like.
Yeah.
So how do you making sure that they are getting right material to debate upon?
Yeah.
So like there's every people will be having like their own opinions, and if they are like going freely on the internet and searching the content, so they will get different content.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's good question. Yeah.
How do you make sure that content part that theory?
So this is also a skill. Having well-formed information and gathering well-formed information is a skill. So again, as my class progresses, because one of my things I get to do with my students in about week 8 or 9 is a debate, right? It's some sort of debate. So I need them to turn up with some knowledge, and of course they're going to assess the information. But within the weeks leading up to it, I have them to research different areas and I show them what can be trusted and what can't be trusted. So one of the skills I try and teach them is to say, well, you're reading this newspaper and it says this, right? Why would that newspaper take that position? Like, why is there a reason why that newspaper would take that position? You're reading this article. This article is from which journal? What is the philosophy of that journal? Okay. So one of the things is to not only get the students to read different material, but to also learn the background of where is the philosophical position of the knowledge? Because all knowledge is political, yeah? It all comes with certain biases. So the important thing as a student, I said to a student, you know, you can read that, and you might, what you need to do is also have, again, critical thinking to be able to assess the background of it. You know? So, you know, even here now, I'm reading the newspaper. The last week while I've been here, I'm reading the newspapers. I pick up the newspaper, I read it. I try and do a little bit of searching about the author, about the editor, so I know who owns the newspaper. And obviously the bias you're going to read is going to be an influence of that. And I think, again, this is part of the literacy. Part of the literacy is understanding that that information is political. And where does the politics come from? And I think that's a really powerful skill to have.
Okay, you want to ask a question?
Yeah, just one query, basically. Yeah. Thank you for a very, very innovative and a very, you know, engaging talk. I came all the way just to, you know, gain and I have gained. Thank you for that. So Dr. Arvani Takis, I would just like to know what are the compulsions that you have such a huge class? We don't encourage students to grow into this number where they are kind of, you know, that the space to interact is really becomes reduced in some ways or the other, whether you accept it or not. And then there's the involvement of too many teachers, so that your involvement gets reduced in some ways. Yeah. So I was just wondering what are the compulsions which, you know, the trend is to take so many students,
yeah, it's a trend,
and then have a very elaborate system of teaching.
Yeah. So first of all, I'll say thank you for your kind words. It's a trend across universities in Australia, all universities in Australia. In South Africa, I have a visiting professorship in South Africa, where I visit there once a year and do classes and research. They're the same thing, part of my impetus for this research and this writing and these measures is the rise of large classes. Yeah.
And it's not something I necessarily agree with. It's not something I think is fantastic. But the institutional limitations I have are large classes. And so a lot of my colleagues just went, it's too hard, I'm just going to talk for an hour, and those who survive, survive, those who don't, don't, it's done. And I find that tragic.
Yeah,
it's a tragic thing. Or they dictate. They say, I'm going to dictate, and I'm going to leave it at that. And I find that tragic. So part of this impetus was to say, look, it's different. All right? Some people argue it's worse. Let me not get in that argument of what's better or worse. Let's just say it is. And rather than giving up, how do I ensure that the students are coming to my classroom, have a fantastic experience, and I present pedagogically sound, innovative information? And so that's my impetus. So if I had my way, I mean, it's really good for my ego when I walk into a class of 400 students. It's like I said, academic rock star, yeah? But it's also important that that it's not. I mean, but I will say this, that the way that the system has changed now, it's not just. And I should put it in perspective as well. I shouldn't just say that everyone's a large class. I mean, it's only certain classes, like big core subjects. You know, most of the classes tend to be much smaller. Lots of classes have 30 people. A lot of it's accompanied with other information, be it some online learning material. You know, so it's pedagogically, I mean, I don't always agree with it, but it's not just thrown out on its own. It becomes a different kind of package that's presented. So, I think I might have given the message that it's hopeless, but it's not. It's just a different message for some subjects. And for some subjects it can work. For other subjects like law or certain other subjects, especially in second and third year, it's not like that at all.
Okay, one last question. Yes, please. Yeah, very quickly.
I totally presented the content very well, and thank you for it. Very much effective. One question in my mind that in an inclusive setting, in classroom setting, when there is heterogeneity in the classroom as well as the multilingual, multiculturalism is there, and different languages are spoken. So, what strategies, innovative strategies you follow to deal with those students who are having different languages, who speak different languages? Can you just focus on that part?
Yeah, look, in Australia, English is the official language and is what we teach in English. And so there's support structures for students who their English isn't as strong. There's different support structures. All universities offer, I think, support structures for the students that whose English isn't strong. But in saying that, I think you present a very important point, and that is that in classes, not just large classes, but all classes, you have different levels of students. Yeah. But it becomes really, really focused on large classes. So one of the methodological changes I've implemented, and I do this in Australia, but also we have a relationship with St. Xavier's College in Mumbai, and we've implemented this in one of their classes, and it worked very well. Because we always say to students, we all want to get to the same place. We all want to end up with a good mark, right? But we all have different levels of knowledge, so getting there is going to require different things. So one of the things I do is with my classes is I set, say for example, three different levels of assignment. So one level, say it's on a, I bring paper to class, and I say, okay, so right here, this blue paper, this is for those who feel they're very, very advanced. I want you to take this blue piece of paper, there's a challenge for you here, you have to work on your own. Yeah? This green piece of paper, that piece of paper is for students who feel confident but want to work in a team environment, want to work in a group of three or four students, right? And the challenge is different, but it's not as difficult as this one. And over here I have a pink piece of paper, and that pink piece of paper are for those who are struggling, who feel not struggling, but who don't have the background knowledge. Yeah? So what I want you to do with that piece of paper is I want you to come and take it, and I want you to stay in class with me. So the students select which level. And sometimes I'll pick up one, they'll pick up the blue piece of paper, they'll walk out, they'll come back, they'll put the blue piece of paper, they'll pick up a yellow, orange one, or the green one, I say, that's more for me. Sometimes they'll pick up the pink one and sit with me, and after 5 or 10 minutes they say, actually, I think I'm more confident now. I think I'm more confident than I don't need to be here. So I let them select themselves. And, you know, and what I found is that when I do this, right, I do this, but you have to set up an environment where the student is confident to pick the level. What I found is when I've done this, is the marks of all students have improved. The really strong students are challenged. They're challenged, you know, and they're like, this is so exciting. I'm doing something that's incredibly advanced. I feel really good. They're motivated. The students that, you know, are less advanced, that they're in an environment where they don't feel intimidated. So you see the marks improve. So there are ways to try and manage different ways. So, I mean, we talked, what we were at a college before. I can't remember the college. Yeah, so we were there before, and they raised a similar thing. And I was talking to one of the teachers there, one of the faculty there, and we had a bit of time, so it was really nice, and we chatted. And one of the things I suggested to her was, well, she said, you know, some of the students, their English isn't very good. And I said, well, why don't you set the small assignments in English first and just get them to make it a little bit harder each time, so that way they get more and more confident. So she thought she would try and implement that. So.
Thank you, Professor James, for such an engaging session. May I request my colleague, Dr. Bara Faruqi, to propose a vote of thanks? Thank you.
Well, guys, you've all been listening to an academic rock star, and I'm sure we've all really thoroughly enjoyed the session. And it was wonderful to know that, you know, one can teach over 1,000 students, you know, at a time, and students with as many varied languages as 178 languages, you said, at least, you know, in a single classroom. It's really mind-blowing, and I feel really encouraged to know that, you know, that one can have such a diverse classroom situation. And as far as the, you know, innovative teaching methodologies are concerned, I mean, it was really enlightening to listen to you, and the way, you know, you talked about case studies and how then you ultimately reach the theory. First you talk about the practical aspect of it, and I think, I'm sure it's going to be really, I mean, a lot of things, of course, we as teachers also have experienced, and we partially also kind of practice what you've told us, but I'm sure we're going to really benefit a great deal after having heard you today. And, you know, I think we want to particularly appreciate your point about not just about that knowledge is not all, but we have to add skill and culture. And the culture that you talked about, the culture of learning to learn. So I think that's a very interesting point that, you know, we as teachers can raise in the classroom, that we have to build a culture of learning to learn. So we have to be ready to accept that we need to learn more, and we are all, you know, learners. So I really loved your lecture, and on behalf of the outreach program Jamia Millia Islamia and all of us present here, I would like to thank you, Professor James. I didn't exert my memory, because I thought that, you know, I don't want to consume the 10% you said that which gets consumed in remembering your name, because I myself, you know, my name was also pretty difficult to pronounce for most Indians, you know, North Indians, and so I can understand the pain of, you know, trying to make people pronounce your name correctly. So I don't want to mispronounce it either. So that way I'm not going to pronounce it at all, probably. So thank you so much, and I thank the audience and all of you, and Professor Talat Aziz, our officiating Vice Chancellor. Thank you very much for being with us, and I invite all of you for a cup of tea now. Thank you.